So a church member said to me some weeks ago, and this person is comfortable with my sharing the following. I have a roof over my head, a job I like, good friends, food on the table, so shouldn't I be happier? Yes, you should. Oh, we've got some good time here. So, you know, if you needed to get off and do some early Christmas shopping, then no, it's actually, it's not so simple, is it? Of the nations of the world, America has a unique relationship with happiness, the pursuit of which is codified in the Declaration of Independence. I'm not familiar with another constitution or a founding document that has such an affirmation. And not except for the constitutional monarchy of Bhutan, which has a gross national happiness quotient and not a gross national product. But that's for another time. Our idea is really revolutionary, that American citizenship, regardless of one's wealth, one's status, bestows on us this mandate to first hunt for and then attempt to gather this most elusive of quarries. A self-defined Unitarian, Thomas Jefferson's words about happiness in the Declaration might have benefited from a touch of Buddhism. Eric Hoffer wrote, now some years ago, that the search for happiness is one of the chief sources of unhappiness. The Buddha would have expressed Hoffer's sentiments differently, but the warning would have been very much the same. Our ambitions and attachments often lead us astray. It's not what we tend to think about. We tend to think that we ought to have goals, we should have missions. We don't disagree with that, mind you, the Buddha and I, who are just like this. It's just that we need to be self-aware that sometimes they entrap us, that when we really yearn for something desperately, then we don't end up in the place we were hoping. An expression the Buddha would not have used is also one that he would have understood. Sociologists refer to the hedonic treadmill, meaning the more pleasures and comforts we accrue, the more we seem to want or need. So we head on down the hedonic treadmill, never reaching our goals, because as soon as we reach the number 3 miles, then 4 miles beckon. And you get the picture. Once we get to 4, we have to move on to 5, so we're never really satisfied, and we keep on walking. Perhaps a universal truth could be expressed this way. There is an unhappiness about not being happy, an unhappiness that grows larger and larger and deeper the more we require happiness, expect, or demand it. This leads us to several axioms, which I will share now. Number one, happiness is as much a matter of luck as effort. That's not something that we always are open to hearing. It's not that effort is inconsequential, it's just that it's not the full picture. Skin color, who our parents were, these have the ability to shape our lives. It's said that a difference between America and Great Britain can lie in the kinds of questions that we ask of one another when we're first getting acquainted. Americans are prone to ask, what do you do? Brits are prone to ask, where did you go to school? Geography is often destiny. Living in a ghetto, living in Rwanda or Fort Collins, growing up in rural Mexico or urban Detroit, our autobiographical situation is relevant to our happiness. And I'll put it a different way. We didn't build it, even if we're talking about ourselves. Axiom number two, All cultures have words for happiness, but our definitions vary. In the West, we tend to speak a lot about personal happiness, as if it were possible to be personally happy regardless of what else is going on around you in your society, your culture, or your world. That's an odd view, in my opinion. It suggests that somehow that it's okay, that what really matters is how I'm doing, and for the rest of you, well, you're on your own. In other societies, happiness is viewed as collective. We're in this together. Personal happiness is relational. It's based on the fact that we are all doing well. And if we're not all doing well, then each one of us is not doing well either. Interestingly enough, though, in survey after survey of all the countries of the world, most people report being happy. The scores range from 5 to 10 on a 10-point scale, one being I'm not, and 10 being I'm ecstatic. So 5 to 10, those are not bad scores when you consider that we are surveying people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Rwanda, and other nations. That leads us to axiom 3, generalizing from person to person or from nation to nation as to what truly constitutes happiness is ultimately frustrating because our definitions vary so greatly. This is something I'm not sure we fully understand, that our personal definitions of happiness in this room can vary tremendously. Now, I know that there are some of us who would truly be happy if we could spend the afternoon in the library, that is like just fine. If we could be in the library with the sun shining in, it would be all we would want for our afternoon. And for others, it just sounds awful. So one person's trash is another's treasure, and one person's delight is another's disaster. And we really mix things up if we try to impose our definitions on someone else. In his wonderful book, The Geography of Bliss, former NPR broadcaster Eric Weiner, it's W-E-I-N-E-R, traveled to a number of nations between 06 and 07, and he turns a journalist's eye for both detail and irony into a fast-moving narrative. And because it's the geography of bliss, and because he looks at a number of different nations and persons, he's also aware that his last name, which is pronounced Weiner, could have an impact on the results of his investigation. His travels to the Netherlands, Switzerland, Bhutan, Qatar, Iceland, Moldova, Thailand, Great Britain, India, and the United States confirm axiom 3. When it comes to describing and understanding happiness, generalizations are of dubious value. And I have written my own axiom 4. However misguided, inappropriate, sloppy, inaccurate, and just plain wrong our generalizations about anything might be, we promote them relentlessly anyway. Like Karl Rove on election night, we refuse to accept the fact that the world is not nearly as simple as we'd like it to be. Now, we need to generalize. We survive through generalization, but we also perish through inaccurate generalization. So I sympathize. I would love to be able to offer you 5 surefire steps to increasing your happiness, which I think is a really good title for a surefire bestseller in the American self-help industrial complex. And you may have that title. I will not copyright it. But try to write 5 surefire steps to happiness. If we're intellectually honest and spiritually aware, we quickly realize that there is no secret key to the happiness door, no magic bridge across the chasm of life to take us to nirvana or Shangri-La or heaven. There is no wizard who can take us back to Kansas, or for Rush Limbaugh, no magician who will take him back to the early 1800s in America, where we know he would be happiest because most black people couldn't vote then. Let's return to the question that prompted the sermon. Shouldn't we experience a higher degree of happiness if we have shelter, friends, loved ones, good jobs, and a decent income? My answer is that I think what we experience and should experience, let's put it out there, is gratitude. To not experience gratitude is to be ignorant of where we stand in the world. We can be grateful for all we have, all that we enjoy, and equally be unhappy that our situation is unusual, even remarkable among the peoples of this planet, too many of whom are hungry, ill, struggling for survival, or subject to oppressive power structures. And a number of these people are our fellow citizens. I am grateful for all I have, and I feel myself to be a happy person. But I would say that I am happy enough. As one of the privileged of the earth, I feel a moral imperative to place my life, identity, and possessions in the context of other lives with whom I share this planet. Of course, I want to be happy, and you do too. Here's the bottom line. If we were to say there's a book that makes you happy, a person, the love of your life to make you happy. If there's a place you could live that would make you happy. If there's knowledge you could get, a religion to follow, you'd do it. But the bottom line is the happiness. If it's not a single person, that's okay. If it's not a book or a religion or a philosophy or a place, it's okay. Everything is okay as long as we're happy, because that's what we want. We don't have to be wealthy. We don't have to be smart. We don't have to have anything except happiness. But we also want to be conscious and aware. And I yearn to inhabit a place of balance between cynicism, anger, and grumpiness on the one hand, and ignorant bliss on the other. But does my awareness of the unhappiness of others paradoxically promote my own happiness with myself, a self-satisfied ego boost? Look how compassionate I am. How aware of the problems of the world. Am I not really, therefore, one of the very best people I know? And that is true happiness. I hope I am most often self-aware enough not to be entrapped by my ego. But ego is tenacious, cunning, and deceitful. If we're not careful, it's very easy to fall in love with ourselves, our ideas, our values, our beliefs, or our misery, our self-sacrifice, and our martyrdom. I believe what often saves us from narcissism, which I think is the great temptation in America in 2012, is what the late poet, priest, and philosopher John O'Donohue called our longings, the feeling that something is missing from our lives. John O'Donohue is this remarkable person. He grows up in Ireland to a poor family. He's the son of a stonemason, but he's brilliant. And so he enters the priesthood, which is the vehicle for education for many in Ireland, and he goes to Germany and earns a PhD and develops new understandings of the philosophy of Hegel, of all people. He remains a priest, but he's a poet, and he's best known internationally for his first book, Anam Cara, which is a book of Celtic spirituality. It's also a book about friendship. And then the other books that follow, he writes deeply about our spiritual life. These are words from his book, Eternal Echoes. And this is a section called The Feeling That Something Is Missing. The human heart is inhabited by many different longings. In its own voice, each one calls to your life. Some longings are easily recognized, and the direction in which they call you is clear. Other voices are more difficult to decipher. At times, your heart settles. You feel you have arrived. You relax and let yourself belong with all your heart. Then the voice whispers, and your belonging is qualified. The voice always makes you feel that something is missing. Even when everything you want is on your table and everyone you love is there in your life, you still feel something is missing. You are not able to name it. If you could, you might be able to go somewhere to get it, but you cannot even begin. Something that feels vital to you lies outside of your reach in the unknown. That's not the message that most of us have been used to hearing. What we get is that what we need and what we want is available. We simply need to recognize it and grab hold of it. The voice comes from your soul. It's the voice of the eternal longing within you, and it confirms you as a relentless pilgrim on the earth. There is something within you that no one or nothing else in the world is able to meet or satisfy. Imagine movies that end with the heroine and the hero drifting apart, identifying each as not the answer to their happiness. No wealth, no accomplishment, no great symphony written. There is something within you that no one or nothing else in the world is able to meet or satisfy. When you recognize that such unease is natural, it will free you from getting on the treadmill of chasing ever more temporary and partial satisfactions. The eternal longing will always insist on some door remaining open somewhere in all the shelters where you belong. Whether it's a window or a door, there is no sanctuary. There's a hole. There's something that's open, and you can't lock it or close it. When you befriend this longing, it will keep you awake and alert to why it is that you are here on earth. It will intensify your journey, but also liberate you from the need to go on many seductive but futile quests. Longing can never be fulfilled here on earth. Does that sound depressing in some ways? It's not supposed to be. Here's what's depressing: the idea that you can grasp hold of something that makes it all okay. That there's something just waiting around the corner for you to grab hold of that will make everything good. It's not there. It's not supposed to be. Give it up. The belief that promotes our consistent, lifelong unhappiness is the idea that there is something just around the corner that we are missing, but we can connect with. Happiness is not something to seize, it's something to grow. It's not a thing of accomplishment, it's a matter of grace. We are necessarily beings of longing, restlessness, of pilgrimage. And when we befriend our longings, accept them as natural, necessary, and good, we are liberated from the obsession to be happy. And in that liberation, we find what the Buddha felt centuries ago to be our ultimate realization, enlightenment. But enlightenment, well, what the Buddha means, is the one who wakes up. Enlightenment is just a fancy way of saying that a person is awake, aware of one's nature and the nature of the world. And being awake is only a different way of saying happy.